70 record closing highs so far for the Dow.
Blasting through a ceiling.
In a record-setting IPO.
Investors who have been riding the wave.
When the stock market is booming, we're made to believe the economy is booming.
As the stock market goes, so goes the wealth and the health and economy.
So what exactly is the stock market measuring?
Capital FM, today the 9th of March. And you know what happens every Tuesday? It so happens to be my mother's birthday. So happy birthday, mommy. So this is the Financial Focus, a show that delves to seek into what is happening into our economy. You are with me, Nyambura Ndongo, alongside Ken Gishinga, our doctor of mathematics. Chief Economist, Mentoria Economics, and you're listening to us at 98.4 Capital FM. You can catch us online at www.capitalfm.co.ke. We value your comments, your feedback, so you can get us on our WhatsApp line 0701-984-984 and on our socials, Facebook, X at Capital FM Kenya, hashtag Financial Forecast Ken. Let me tell you what is happening this beautiful month of April. It so happens that it is Financial Literacy Month. Now, the good thing with us at Financial Forecast, we do not wait to be telling our people how to be smart, how to make wise business decisions. We do this every single Tuesday. So, Ken, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Nyambura. It's a pleasure to see you.
Yeah.
On this another episode of Financial Forecast.
Yeah.
And as you say, April is the month of financial literacy. So if there's a month dedicated to helping people understand how to navigate their personal circumstances, this is it. And I think it's going to be a good April for us.
It is. And, you know, as we were mentioning last, a few weeks ago, when we start talking about inflation, we start talking about interest rates, we start talking about the economy, everyone will be like, that stuff is too complicated for me. But like the last 2 years, I think Kenyans have woken up to a very interesting realization. Right now, I can tell you everybody understands what's happening on eTeams. Ask about the sugarcane farmers. Now everybody really is understanding. So we value that you're with us, you're listening to us. And as Ken said, you know, information is always power. And one thing I can tell you is that you can stay informed by starting your week by having a report that is actually looking at the state of the economy. And you can get this report by emailing info@mentoria.co.ke. And you can reach out to the same email, info@mentoria.co.ke, to get all your economic insights, your data analyses, and forecasts. Now, Ken, as we're on this journey of enrichment, financial information enrichment, last week we did have a guest with us, Mr. Sospita Viga. I think I've said it with all the Kikuyu-ness that it should be. Head of Risk at CPF. And I really did enjoy the session that we had, and I actually think we need to have Sospita back because we didn't even get to half of the risks and opportunities that are actually happening in 2024. What was your key takeaway?
Oh, it was a fantastic episode.
Yeah.
I think Sospita is the head of risk at CPF.
Yeah.
I think he gave us a very compelling explanation of why risk management matters, not just for the big multinationals, but for everyday businesses.
True.
And I think he's parting short about boards, how boards need to create an environment that's safe to fail.
Right.
I found that very powerful because innovation can only happen when people are trying things.
Yeah.
If you try 10 things, chances are 5 will succeed and 5 will fail. So you do need to have people who are comfortable to succeed and to fail.
Yeah.
And the board has to create that environment because agility is the name of the game. So I think that parting shot, I think for me, was sort of the most powerful.
Nice. And you know, they normally say, at least you've learned 5 ways of not to do something, of how not to do something. I think my takeaway was the fact that amongst the risks that we are facing in the global economy that we are in, rather global world, is the misinformation and disinformation. when you talked about AI and deepfake, and now we are embracing all this, and we have actually seen how it can be used. Like, the more we progress in one thing, there's always a dark side to it, and that is where we currently are facing. How to maneuver that? I think we are getting Sospita back, because he needs to give us all this insight from a risk perspective. But
indeed, that's quite it's a very topical area, yeah, particularly the area of AI.
Right.
And I think AI is only going to become a bigger and bigger concern.
Quite so.
In fact, I met one young university student, mm-hmm, who's very passionate,
right,
about AI. And he told me, Ken, you know, your entire show, I can be able to do it via AI. So I challenged him. He'll take all our voices, right, and he can create a whole episode, okay, using AI. So we have to be careful.
We do.
With what the potential of AI can do. It's incredible. Just going through our databases of past episodes, it,
right,
can pick your voice, it can pick my voice, it, wow, can put together content that's,
is going to sound like
sound us, visible and found sounds very compelling, and I challenged him. So
okay,
watch his face.
I think let us get to know, if at all our listeners, you'll figure out if it is us the next time. But that's, you know, I think we always used to fear that our faces, and I'm sure there are so many people who are like, I'm not going to be on social media, I've removed all my photos, all my, but now it's even going beyond photos to your voice, even image, as long as you have anything out there in the interwebs, you're prone to becoming a clone. Anyway, yeah, let us go into the major economies, Ken. So the much awaited key inflation figures are yet to be released tomorrow. And we've been talking about how the markets are a bit shaky, jittery, price rate cuts and inflation numbers. What is happening in the US?
Absolutely spot on. There is mixed reaction, mm-hmm, from the stock market. Everybody's expecting the print,
right,
to come tomorrow, around 6 p.m.
Okay.
Tomorrow, okay, I don't think will be a holiday in the US.
Oh, they don't.
It's a trading day. So, obviously that will drive the stock markets, mm-hmm, in the sense that the last two prints have been higher than what's been expected.
Uh-huh.
People will start looking for hints of, is it starting to come down?
Okay.
The Fed maintains an inflation target of 2%.
Okay.
So the question is, are we getting closer to that 2% or not? And that will weigh heavily on interest rate expectations, mm-hmm, which have been changing.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the very beginning of this year, we were talking about 3 rate cuts,
yes,
this year.
Yeah.
Expectations keep receding. Now people are talking of September,
mm-hmm,
December. So tomorrow's number will have huge impacts on financial markets. It will give us a clue on where interest rates will likely be.
Okay.
So I think it will be a very important trading event.
And you know what we normally do on financial forecast? What do you foresee? I know we looked at the key drivers of inflation using the last report that came out. Do you think that is going to be the same as what we are likely going to be seeing tomorrow, in terms of employment, there are small businesses? What is going to drive this?
Well, obviously, as I said, the last 2 months, it has been a bit higher than expected.
Okay.
I expect it now to start coming down.
Right.
Because interest rates have been high for long enough. Businesses are hurting, particularly small business.
Mm.
In fact, if you look at some of the economists who are looking at small businesses,
right,
they're saying you need to look at that as a harbinger for a recession,
mm,
because small businesses tend to have less capital,
right,
than big businesses. So they are far more sensitive to economic changes, and small businesses are not hiring as much. If anything, they're letting people go. So I think from an inflation perspective, I think demand should start cooling.
Right.
So expect to see a lower print,
okay,
than in previous months. But you never know. Where energy comes in, it could easily go different. But I really expect inflation to start cooling down.
Okay. Well, in China, we were discussing how they do have a very aging population. And there is an opinion piece that was going out that their model and strategy for growth is going to be hitting them and impacting them, considering their population, very high population, aging population, but at the same time, the backdrop of what they say they are the manufacturers of the world. So what are we looking at in terms of China?
No, very, very powerful point on China there. You know, when you talk about why China is slowing down, mm-hmm. there are many reasons we give. Number one, we talk about their property market yes. has not been doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
It's highly indebted. We've seen the Evergrande
yeah.
Really getting into receivership. Mm-hmm. We've also seen the population, as we say, it's an aging population. But most importantly, mm-hmm. and I think the most powerful point that is least talked about has been the Chinese growth model
right.
for the last 40 years. The Chinese growth model has been an export-oriented. So you have cheap labor,
okay.
you have cheap natural resources,
yeah.
so you can become the factory of the world.
Of the world.
And you can be able to export your products to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is it works well when the world is globalizing.
Yeah.
But when the globalization is in recession and countries are starting to become more protectionist,
right.
then it becomes a big challenge. So now China has to deal with the fact that it needs to consume its own products. And I saw an interesting statistic that China builds about 33% of global factory products,
yeah.
but only consumes 13%.
Wow.
Of that. So it tells you there's a whole over excess capacity.
Yeah.
So China depends on the rest of the world growing. But the rest of the world is facing high interest rates.
Yeah.
The rest of the world is facing more closed geopolitics.
Mm-hmm.
The politics of closing economies have become very popular.
True.
We saw last week with Senegal,
mm-hmm.
the president was talking about economic patriotism.
Right.
Buy Senegal, build Senegal. So when the world is moving that direction, the demand for imported goods from China
wow.
become less. So I think China is now left with a lot of items. Its population cannot consume as much as it does. Number one, the purchasing power has really weakened.
Okay.
During the COVID pandemic, people lost jobs.
True.
But it's also an aging population. In fact, one strategist referred to it as the world's largest nursing home.
Does that mean? No, there are very many nursing jobs that are out there in the West.
Yeah. But now if you contrast that with the American economic
yeah.
model, where consumption, local demand, is really what drives
mm-hmm.
American growth. So American
wow.
cars are made for Americans. American laptops
are
made for Americans. Yes, they do export something, but it's not a their major part. I think almost a third of the economy is really driven by local consumption. That's a far more resilient
economy
because whether the world is globalizing or it's closing down, you still have your market because
yes.
at the end of the day, demand is what drives production. So America has its home demand, a big population,
right.
almost 300 million people who are primarily consuming. So those are the things that I think have made China's economy not sustainable. And that's the reason Janet Yellen made that interesting comment that China cannot export its way out of a recession.
Well, I can tell you where they are. They are in Africa. So
that's
well, we did see that there was a partnership that is seeking to employ over 4,000 Kenyans. Rivertex finally coming up, and I'm sure we're going to be, maybe we'll mention it when we come to Kenya. Yeah, I think these are some of the ways that they're thinking of expanding because I'm also thinking, do they also have local produce that they make themselves and they consume? If at all you look at, they only consume the 13%. So the rest, is it that they consume things that they already make for themselves and then they do not want all these products that they're manufacturing for other countries? Is that...
I mean, if you look at the pork market,
mm-hmm.
for example, China has one of the largest pork markets mm-hmm. locally.
Wow.
It has to import from the rest of the world. So you'll find in agricultural products,
yeah.
China is a big consumer,
importer.
Whether it's fish,
okay.
you know, South Africa sells most of its fish to China than to its own people. So in terms of our agricultural produce, you have a billion people that you have to feed.
That is a
lot. But now in terms of tech products, the vehicles, the electrical vehicles that are really running China's economy, most of those are going towards Germany. They're going towards the United States. So they're built with a high-end user who isn't in mind, who's not available in China. So to that extent, there is that whole idea of they need to build. You know, China is still a developing country. And as much as it's a member of the G7, has been, it's still actually in many ways
a developing country.
Yeah, indeed, because if you look at income per capita, you know, we look at total GDP, but when you divide it by a billion people, it's actually still, in many ways,
you put things into perspective now.
Exactly. So I think the fundamental thing has to be, how do we start, how do they create a Chinese middle class that can consume all the new apartments that are being built, that can consume all the iPhones that are coming in? But during COVID, so many people lost their jobs that the road to that middle class sort of got broke. And I think part of it is, do they do a stimulus? How do you get people? Because when people are not in jobs, they stop spending.
Yes.
Even if they have money, they stop spending because they are not sure.
They are saving.
Exactly. The saving cut is big, and that is really hurting the Chinese economy. So I think it's about getting a stimulus out. How do we get people more into spending? And I think that's what will really, but it's not easy. It it'll require a significant stimulus before businesses want to hire more people.
Or if at all they're going to change the demographic, then of course that will take like over 20 years by the time now you see this whole demographic change happening. Well, something interesting is happening in Europe. There's a shift, and we are seeing the south of Europe are now the kings of Europe. What is happening in Europe, Ken?
You know, for the longest time, the powerhouses of Europe, Germany and France, have really dominated European economic conversations. But Germany is facing a similar challenge that China is. You can't export yourself to the world. So the southern European countries, the Spains, the Italys, the ones that have always been considered the periphery, actually having booming tourism, they're having a wonderful export potential, they're having lower energy costs, and actually the balance of power is actually tilting towards southern Europe. They're actually becoming the engines of growth. As the likes of Germany are facing recession, France facing recession, England facing a very weak economic growth. So it's very interesting, you know, back in the global financial crisis, you had Germany and Greece not seeing eye to eye. So it's almost very interesting now that these southern countries that really suffered during the global financial crisis, post-COVID are the ones sort of like leading growth. But I think tourism has really helped them. The climate in the Mediterranean is fantastic. COVID built a big tourist demand. People, you know, are locked in for 2 years. So once the doors were opened,
they're really out.
They're really out. And these are the countries that really have the best tourism products because they are the climate, they're on the waterfront. So I think it's interesting how, yes, how economic conversation over the last few years has really changed. And now they have become the pillars of economic growth.
You know, Ken, as we are discussing, we always say that we need to export. Most Africa, Kenya, we need to be exporters of what we are getting. But now the discussion is China and Germany are now exporting way much more than they actually consume. So what is the ideal model for growth? Because at this particular point, it looks like you really can't have it all. The balance is not balancing. What is the ideal model?
I think the ideal model is closer to what the Americans have built. Building domestic demand, building local capacity. because even in the event of global geopolitics,
right,
you have that market to filter. It's about building a middle class. And even in Kenya, that was the idea behind devolution.
Okay.
Let all these counties be small Nairobis with a visible middle class. When you go to Embu, go to Nakuru, so that a farmer here is growing for this market.
Okay.
A farmer here is growing, and that's the most sustainable. When you build a middle class, you have a very strong demand. Every producer now wants to come because they are saying this is a middle class that has good purchasing power and that. The problem with the Chinese model is you look so much outside and you neglect the dynamics inside.
Right.
And once the global environment becomes very untidy, you don't have a local base to support you. They can't even absorb a quarter of the things that you're producing. So it's about balance, but primarily building local capacity so that, you know, can you imagine if you had your laptop being made here? If you had your phones.
Yes.
Yes, I know nowadays there's some phones that are being made here.
Yeah.
But it's about building, and that's why there's that whole buy Kenya, build Kenya. It tends to create a much better economic dynamic. But it's not easy because sometimes they say we have to compete with cheaper products coming from China. But it's a long-term engagement. And you look at, I know we'll talk about Kenya later. Look at like for our onions market, for example. We are so dependent on Tanzania, the onions coming from Tanzania, that to the point where our farmers have, they can't compete. So when Tanzania now has a problem supplying Kenya,
we have
inflation goes up 65% because we don't have local capacity. We don't have people who can say, okay, we're going to supplement. We're dependent. Look at sugar again. Brazil, we get sugar from Brazil, yet we do have our own. So if Brazil has issues, or if there are shipping issues and you don't have local capacity.
Inflation.
Yeah. So it's about really creating a big demand locally and production for that particular one. It's far more sustainable and you are less you're less exposed from a risk management perspective. You're less exposed to geopolitical Russia, Ukraine on wheat.
Yeah.
And that's why Kenya is always, we're always in the eye of the storm when it comes to this. Whether it's Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Hamas,
and you know we didn't
Brazil,
realize that.
I mean.
Yeah, we didn't realize that. We were like, there's Russia. I mean, it's a them problem.
Right.
Until we started seeing grain, and then we are told, oh, you know, you import. Like, what do you mean? We import from Ukraine. And but, you know, we were also having the discussion of Africa and how some countries are still importing things from the West, including food.
What I've just described about Kenya is true across many African countries. In fact, I'd say Kenya is in a better place. We do have a visible agriculture sector.
Right.
I have colleagues in Mozambique. I have colleagues in Gabon, in West Africa, where there's almost zero. Like if you go to Mozambique today, Nyambura, almost all the food that will be on your plate is coming either from South Africa or from Portugal.
Wow.
Even the idea of fresh milk is impossible. They have UHT milk. You go to the Benins of this world, every day there's a airline coming in with chicken and eggs from France, from Belgium. Actually, when people who have traveled across Africa, when they come to Kenya, they really appreciate the fact that you have local vegetables, you have local fresh milk, because these are things that in many West African countries, actually it's they don't have, they've not built that capacity. They import from Brussels, from Paris, Mozambique, from Portugal, from South Africa. So you so become so dependent that even in the event of geopolitical thing, you're really exposed because, you know.
But if at all we have all this agricultural land, our weather is fantastic, why is it that they have to be importing from the West? Like, the math is not mathing, Ken. What is the problem? We do have so much produce and we have the capacity. In fact, if at all you look at how agriculture can be the main source of, you know, employment in Africa, but such countries are still having a shortfall in terms of agricultural produce.
I mean, it's an opportunity our government has identified, mm-hmm. you remember the president talking about DRC, how Kenya can have enough milk to sell to DRC. Mm-hmm. And not just DRC, because DRC is just a big market, but there are many other markets. And when you talk about the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, I think that's an area Kenya can play very successfully in terms of not just exporting raw material, but also produced.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just exporting milk, you could process, make yogurt, make ice cream,
and actually,
and be able to export and do some value addition.
Quick break. Capital FM. And welcome back. 98.4 Capital FM. This is the Financial Forecast, a show that seeks to delve into matters, economy, and everything that is happening within your wallet in terms of money matters. You're with me, Nyambura Ndongo, alongside Ken Gishinga, Chief Economist, Mentoria Economics, and you're listening to us at 98.4 Capital FM. And you can catch us online at www.capitalfm.co.ke/listenlive. We value your comments and your feedback, so please reach out to us on our WhatsApp line 0701-984-984, our socials, Facebook, X, at Capital FM Kenya, hashtag Financial Forecast. And April being the month of financial literacy, please do let us know something that you would absolutely love to know. And I think we'll have a brief moment to actually get into educating and letting you know what that means. So, Ken, welcome back. We were discussing our beautiful continent, Africa. Now, something interesting is happening in Zimbabwe. They they have unveiled a new currency. As depreciation and inflation, they have wreaked havoc and turmoil within the country. And the last time they did that was in 2009. But how many times did you say they've done this?
About 5 times over the last 20 years.
Wow. And I remember in 2009, they had, is it $1 trillion? Was it $1 trillion note? And Ken, you know, the one thing, the backdrop of economics, the backdrop of any economy is learning from your past, and as well as we discuss risks. And I mean, there's already a story that you already have. What is happening in Zimbabwe? Because they announced on Friday that they have changed, and it's already actually in circulation. It is being used. But why? What necessitated it? Why are they here?
Yeah, I mean, they did announce that they have a new currency that's anchored on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
The idea there was to build confidence. A currency needs to demand respect in the marketplace. And the previous currency had been losing value. In fact, the US dollar controls about 20-30% of Zimbabwean economic affairs, just because of the issues they've had with the local currency. So they've had monetary crisis after monetary crisis. This is their latest experiment. It's anchored on the dollar, on gold.
Yeah.
So I expect it to have some level of stability because they do have the gold reserves in their bankers.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back at the last 20 years,
obviously
Zimbabwe has gone through a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Economically speaking, they've had periods where they've printed much more currency than maybe was necessitated.
Really?
And that triggered not just inflation, but
hyperinflation.
In fact, when you talk about hyperinflation in economics,
that is
the two countries that come to mind are Zimbabwe. And Germany in the 1920s when they had a hyperinflation. Mm. So obviously this is an attempt, and to be fair, the world operated on a gold standard before 1971. So what they're doing is really where the world was. So confidence might come there because everybody will be saying, you know, this currency is backed by something.
Yeah.
And that was the argument of the gold standard that was there. The only challenge with the gold standard globally is there wasn't enough gold to keep up with the demands of the people.
Okay.
Zimbabwe is a growing population, mm-hmm. young economy, so population is growing. And the challenge with the gold standards pre-1971 globally mm-hmm. was there wasn't enough gold in the mines
okay.
to keep up with demand for currency. And that's why at some point the U.S. under Nixon had to say, we have to get off this.
Okay.
Prior to that, you could take your note,
yeah.
go to Fort Knox, and actually get
change
for gold.
Okay.
But they saw that was not sustainable. Gold production was not keeping up
yeah.
with the demand. And that might be the challenge Zimbabwe might have, where, yes, the currency has confidence because it's anchored on a real commodity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the challenge will be growth might be very muted
right.
because you just don't have enough gold to keep up with the demands of a young, growing, vibrant. You know, Zimbabwe is not like Germany.
Right.
That it's a very young
China.
China. It's very very young population,
uh-huh.
booming.
Right.
Our population is booming. So from a currency perspective, and that's where the world moved away from gold standard to fiat.
Uh-huh.
Fiat just means by law.
Right.
And fiat allows you to expand as the population expands. So how they escape that limitation of a gold standard. So it'll give them the confidence. It'll give investors confidence.
Mm-hmm.
That's the positive side.
Okay.
The negative side is the growth may be very muted because
right.
you just don't have enough currency to keep up with the population. So you might end up having cash crunch.
Mm-hmm.
Nyamburu, when you go to Zimbabwe, they don't even have smaller unit coins, enough of them.
Is it like the one bob that we have?
They don't have enough of that. So what they do
right.
is actually they give you sweets or they give you chocolates or they give you pens.
Is that where we got that one from last? Was it like 2 years ago? Three?
When you don't have these smaller denominated coins,
oh.
and that's where a lot of transaction.
Yeah,
that's where somebody who's buying a cigarette,
yeah.
somebody who's buying a pen.
Yes.
That's where a lot of transactions happen. When you don't have enough food,
right.
you know, you go to what they call the Kadogo economy.
Right.
Everything is bought by 10 bob, 5
so
bob. So you need to have enough currency. And thankfully, us in Kenya, now we have mobile money.
Yes.
So
if
it's 5 shillings, you could have it.
Oh, that saved the CBK when we had that.
Right. But they're not there in Zimbabwe. So these are some of the challenges that they have to address, especially in poorer economies. You need to have the low unit currency more abundantly, because
yeah.
that's where most transactions
happening.
People can't afford whole bars of soap. People afford just a piece of it.
Yeah.
So for that, you need to have currency that's a very basic unit. So those are some of the things that they have to address moving forward. But my word, it has been a tough time for Zimbabwe.
I know the central bank in Zimbabwe are having sleepless nights because Ken. I'm trying to think, how is this all done? How do they phase out the currency that they currently have? Does that mean, if at all, I have my 1,000 bob, which has lost its value? So they'll tell me, like, 10,000 bob notes are going to give me one new currency, which they're calling what, ZIG, is it?
Right.
Yeah. It's going to give me that one ZIG. But now, the ZIG is backed by the gold which the government should have. Is that it?
And the ZIG stands for Zimbabwean gold.
Right.
That's exactly the situation as it is. And there are many ways countries introduce a new currency.
Mm-hmm.
For Zimbabwe, they have given people time,
okay.
about a month, to bring back the old currency. They have issued a conversion ratio
okay.
that will be applied.
Right.
Remember in Kenya during 2019, the demonetization,
yes.
we had about 2-3 months
yes.
to be able to change the currency. So best practice is to give people time because sometimes people are not in their home areas.
Right.
They're out of the country.
The money is under a mattress.
Exactly. But India tried a very shocking thing. India... Uh-huh. One evening, really, Modi came on air
right.
and just said, as of tonight,
this is not going to be legal tender.
Yeah, and it caused so much commotion.
I can imagine.
It caused a lot of confusion. Even suicides happened. So that's not the way to do it. You always want to give people time to be able to adjust to the new currency, maybe 3 months.
Yeah,
that is the way. But yeah, the way India had did it, to this date, there's still elements of Indian society that have not recovered because of that.
Because they did actually have the money. And if at all, I remember the best class I've had with Mr. Tony Mwiti was that if at all you have the currency and you can actually use it, and then one day it is actually termed not useful, then I think you've destabilized literally everything in terms of economy, in terms of what we know as money. And the other thing that you just mentioned is the fact that the small trader or the small person down there who has the small coins and the small, which are very few to get, how many of that do they have to get to actually get the ZiG? And I can imagine, is it now just going to be like barter trade where I'll come and tell you, okay, I need milk, but I have a chicken. You'll kind of have to take it because I'm not going to really use gold to be buying milk.
I think it'll play out differently in the different segments of society. Mm-hmm. As I said, the US dollar, as we speak,
it's already been used, yes.
It's already in use. I think about 20-30%
yes.
of the economy. So you'll find the high-end part of the society, the corporates,
they're
already being paid in dollars.
Yeah.
They pay their rent in dollars.
Yes. Okay,
so that segment is somewhat covered. Now, it's what about the bottom of the pyramid, which is where the population is. And this is where ZiG is supposed to provide a jig, if you like.
I like that.
In that particular area, obviously, I think this to them is going to answer the question of, can our leaders not overprint?
Yeah.
Because this now we provide you with a discipline. You have this much gold, you can only have this much currency.
Yeah.
So the indiscipline of overprinting currency, I think that has been cured.
Right.
If they maintain the accounting well. So that might introduce confidence. But again, how much of that will be available
exactly.
in the agricultural areas with the beef ranchers far out of Harare? You know, how are they going to? So I think that's going to be the big, big part because, at the end of the day, you find butter trading starts rearing its head again.
Wow. And what is the difference between change of currency and you've just mentioned demonetization?
Well, they're quite similar.
Right.
For Kenya, we were just simply changing the face, the note.
Yeah.
So the currency is still the Kenya shilling.
It is the Kenya shilling.
So
a thousand for a thousand.
Exactly.
Okay.
So if you're paid X thousand shillings, it's going to be X thousand shillings.
Okay.
When you change a currency, this is similar to the European Union on the year 2000, when all the 20 states, like Germany, had its German marks.
Uh-huh.
When some of the other countries had their own currencies, the drachmas, when they all had to convert, and on January 1st, 2000, they all had to use the euro. So even the values changed. So if you're being paid, like if you're an accountant in Hamburg, and you're being paid 20,000 Deutschmarks, on January 1st, 2000, you're paid in euros.
Yeah.
So it's a whole orientation, and that's a change of currency. So the European Union is one example, and it was quite smooth. I don't know why India didn't copy that.
Right.
It was very smooth. It was, I think, it was of a whole year of changing. So that's a change of currency, but still the impacts. Even in Kenya, during that demonetization, we saw currency in circulation really drop.
Okay.
It was actually a tough economic times. I think most Kenyans don't remember it.
Right.
Because COVID was so much worse.
Yes.
But actually, people who monitor these things will tell you, wow, 2019, especially after September, you could hear traders saying, oh, wow, there isn't enough of this going around. So if remonetization is not done as quickly as demonetization, you end up having a cash crunch, and that cash crunch affects demand for goods and services.
And of course now prices for goods and services as well.
Right.
Now, there was a feud with our neighboring country, Uganda, which has now been sorted. And it looks like oil prices here in Kenya, I think, I don't know if at all they're going to change, because now there's the oil feud between Uganda and Kenya has come to an end. Ken, what happened? What was the genesis of this? But at the same time, what is interesting is Uganda seems to be choosing Tanga as the port of preference in terms of getting also their oil. So please help us understand, where did this come from? What was the problem? And what is the outcome now?
Well, the watershed moment, right, Nyambura, was when Kenya announced its G2G
oh, wow, that
deal.
One. That one.
That really was a moment.
Okay.
Because now Kenya was having a government to government, which much later on, I think everybody regrets.
Yeah, it didn't go through.
At that point, Uganda, many months later, said it can also have its own G2G arrangement with Bahrain.
Oh.
Because our G2G was with the UAE. So Uganda said they can also have their own arrangement. Now, the question was, okay, so what does that mean in terms of the infrastructure use?
Yes. All right.
And the constitutional interpretation for them was, we still use the same infrastructure, but we purchase in our own terms. So I think that whole understanding of infrastructure had to go to the regional courts.
Okay.
It was finally settled. It messed up the diplomatic relations a bit. Mm. I think in hindsight, Kenya might wish they would never
have
announced, because as you say, even with this feud being resolved, Uganda is already shopping around.
Yeah, they want to use Tanga.
Because it's not sure when we might come up with another
G2G
original idea. And right. And it shows you how economics and foreign policy are bedfellows. They have to. Whenever you're crafting economic policy, especially things of fuel where there is inter-country dependency, you have to be very careful in how it will be interpreted in the other side, because Uganda is our closest trading partner. That's the country you want to keep it, really. It's the biggest consumer of our products. So it's the last country
you want to
rattle. And that's what we did. So I think it's in future, as we craft our economic policy, we need to think about who are our big dependents. And Uganda, you can't do anything in Kenya without thinking about Uganda, because it's your biggest market. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to be a producer, they'll be the number one country to buy. So you really want to be on the best terms and avoid constitutional court cases that go against you.
So you know, now, since the verdict is out and they are now allowed to bring in their oil from Bahrain, but through its KPC?
Correct.
And we are still with UAE. So they're going to be having shifts, like you bring yours in April, I bring mine in June. Do you think maybe, and a 14th is just around the block, something can change and maybe our fuel prices will come down maybe by like 10 shillings?
I think for the logistics of how they do that, we have to bring an oil expert.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with the infrastructure, but the infrastructure is the same. But how they sequence that this is for local, this is, I mean, I think there we'll have to bring the likes of George Washira, who's a renowned petroleum expert. Maybe one day we'll reach out to him.
Definitely.
But it's quite fascinating how you have a commodity that could be independently negotiated, independently priced. It's the same commodity.
It is the same commodity.
But the terms of it are very different. So it's extremely interesting how physically that actually
happens. I'm sure probably even the rate at which Uganda is going to be paying Bahrain is going to be different from what you're going to be paying the UAE. Okay. Well, I can tell you what is happening. We're much closer to our pockets. And, well, the CBK had a very busy last week, and the MPC did meet. So I think for the sake of Teddy Martin And Charles Kiari, you will tell us who the MPC are and what the interest rates mean and what they did on top for that. But on top of that is the interest rates for the T-bills have dropped for the first time in 2 years. We did talk about that. You're also going to tie that in as we come and see what is happening to our loans. So the MPC.
The MPC stands for the Monetary Policy Committee. Mm-hmm. This is a committee that considers the role of monetary policy, mm-hmm. Advises on the best interest rates, looking at inflation and other variables. They did meet last week.
Right.
Normally they meet every 2 months. Mm-hmm. And the decision at that time was to maintain the policy rate at 13%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think at that time they saw inflation is well anchored.
Right.
It was at 5.7%. The currency, you saw yesterday it was at 127. Mm-hmm. It's quite incredible.
Yeah.
So I think for them they saw their previous hikes are working,
right.
And there is no need for any further interest rate raises.
Okay.
But the question is, should they consider cutting interest rates? Because mm-hmm. some of the statistics they provided, non-performing loans are extremely high. I think it's about 15.5%, almost a record high.
Right.
Credit to the private sector has really cooled down. It was at 13% growth, now it's about 10%.
Right.
So we are getting to a place where there is a cash crunch. The economy is slowing down. And one of the very, very big questions, particularly for their next meeting in June,
mm-hmm.
is at what point should they start thinking about lowering interest rates? In fact, what you've said on the government auction side, they've already started signaling lower interest rates. So the days of 18% bonds are well behind us.
Right.
But still, 16% is still very expensive. And even I think they are starting to appreciate that high interest rates are not sustainable in an economy, because it means a lot of your tax revenue will be going towards servicing debt. In fact, in the latest report this fiscal year, from July till February,
mm-hmm.
about 84% of our revenue
has gone to
towards
debt.
Servicing debt. So I think even they are realizing you can't be in a high interest rate forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it can help you with your currency, but in the long term, it squeezes out the private sector. It takes away money that should be paying doctors.
True.
Is now going towards servicing debt.
Yeah.
And it can create many other social consequences, because now you can't attend to the things that you are elected to do, because debt is weighing you down. So I think even now the Treasury, the CBK are really eyeing lower interest rates. They're signaling it. There's also plans to cut expenditure in the next budget from 4.2 trillion to 3.7. That will have its impact. I think we need to unpack that a bit more.
Right.
But there is a need, there is a sentiment that they're trying to really cut back and to reduce interest rates moving forward, just because it's not very
sustainable. And I don't know if at all you saw a report that was on the interwebs. I know you always take everything that you see on the internet with a pinch of salt, but there was a review done of the Uhuru government, the Kibaki government, and the Ruto government, and how much of revenue they have in, and how much of that is actually used. And I think for the Kibaki and Uhuru government, development was, I think, about 15%, and now with the Ruto government, I think it was like 7%. I might not be remembering the numbers so accurately, but the highest was the debt, which is highest in the Ruto government, but in the Uhuru government and in the Kibaki, of course, we were discussing how each medium-term plan has seen how the debt has fallen over to the next person and the next person. So for Kibaki, the debt wasn't that high, but there was development that was happening. Then came the Uhuru government, and then there was a lot of development, and that's where most of the borrowing happened. And now it is down to the Ruto side. So do you think this is also playing part in the fact that they're really trying to cut down on spending. Of course, the biggest conversation is, yeah, we can see the travels are still the same. You know, we still have a bloated workforce. We have, I mean, the Auditor General just the other day flagged that, you know, the people are being paid to the Council of, money is being paid to the Council of Governors. There's ghost workers in the Dandora work site. So we can still see there's money, but the use is just not what is prioritized.
That's a remarkable economic history, looking at the three regimes that have played out. The challenge is always in the political economy. When governments come to power, there are some visible projects they want to be seen, whether it's the standard gauge railway, whether it's the Vision 2030. Mm-hmm. People tend to associate progress
something
with very
see.
Tangible. And that's why there's always that push.
Okay.
Either we've built more roads, build more housing. there's always that element that if I'm a politician, I want to be elected, people need to see physical things
evidence.
Moving. The challenge with that, it starts moving the economy towards a publicly driven growth.
Right.
So the government has to spend, the budget every year has to increase much more than the population is increasing. Borrowing has to continue. In fact, if you look at the medium-term plan 4, it took about 16 trillion of expenditure. Where will that come from? Obviously, there'll be more borrowing. The private sector starts being constrained because government, when it goes to borrow, it crowds out. Banks will lend more to government. So that's now the challenging. It's how, as a politician, do you change this dynamic where you deliver services, but not to the extent that you are crowding out the private sector. So if you try and reduce the workforce, like austerity measures, it's very politically unpopular. And that can have a... So it's always a very interesting balance between the politics of the day, which wants to see more public money. MCAs want to travel more. But the reality is you can only tax people to a certain point, and you can only borrow to a certain point without killing the rest of the economy. So that sweet spot is where every administration has to find. And if there's an excess on one side, it can really play out in a negative way.
Which is interesting because as the IMF, I think they've heard the cry of Kenyans because there was a report that was done and there was a paper. And they kept saying that government actually needs to be having at most public participation because now they are seeing increased taxes. People are just not able to even pay this amount of money that the government is really demanding for, which was interesting because, I mean, they are the ones who are leading that conversation, but at the same time, they're telling them, listen, I know we need the money, but you need to listen to your citizens. And it has to be done, and we actually have to see that public participation was done, and you're actually doing all these revisions and plans. In terms of, I think we're coming into even June, they need to actually have a plan that is not going to be killing the economy.
Public participation is crucial in a democracy. They say no taxes without representation. Public participation has to be there. I would even go one step and even be more controversial and say even leaders need to participate. I think we've seen reports of MPs who've said even they didn't know
we didn't read
what was in the Finance Act. So even leaders need to participate, ironically.
Yes.
But it's very important, and hopefully channels like this can be useful as we get to Finance Act 2024 to unpack key parts to the ordinary citizen, because I think that part is what has been lacking. So they're not even able to hold the leaders to account in terms of saying, okay, this tax is going to mean less disposable income and our economy will weaken. That basic formulation sometimes is not there, and that's why you think the leaders are able to convince people that their agenda is true, and later on they'll say actually they didn't read clause A, clause B, clause C. So I think it's very important as we approach Finance Act 2024 that a lot of data starts coming to people.
Yeah.
people start debating in small groups, yep. in media circles, in
they
sessions,
their feedback.
That and getting feedback yeah. that is authentic
yeah,
and
right.
in a way that even the mama mboga
can
understand. Right. I think that's where it's been lacking. Sometimes you're told it's at KICC,
yeah,
this auditorium.
Yeah.
For you to enter
at 7 a.m.
that, because I've attended one of them,
right.
there are so many people at the gate who are stopped.
Oh, because they can't get in. They
either
don't have the
sometimes they ask for the ID.
You don't have an ID.
But you don't require it. But sometimes a guide will ask you, where's your ID?
You
so
don't even carry it.
That's okay. the thing. So okay. they don't even know that it's their right
to
say,
be there.
They yeah. don't have that knowledge that even if you don't have your ID,
you
need
in.
To be there. So right. you find even at the gate, a lot of people. Push back and then they don't participate. So I think it's about strengthening what meaningful public participation looks like. I think that's what's been lacking.
Okay.
Meaningful public participation, not just something that's advertised in the papers.
Yeah.
Then meeting in a social hall for right. 10 people.
An email that is not read.
That's it. Yeah.
I will not ask you to give a parting shot. I think that's. Parting shot enough. Thank you, Ken. We do come to the end of Financial Focus on this beautiful Tuesday evening. And remember, you can get all this information, a bit more in-depth economic insights and data analysis and forecasting by emailing info@mentoria.co.ke. But as we keep saying, if you have missed this episode, if at all you want to listen to each and every other episode that we can listen to, you can get it at our Capital FM SoundCloud page and anywhere you get your podcast from. So I think from myself, Nyambura, and Ken, it is have a pleasant good evening and Eid Mubarak to all our Muslims as they have their holiday tomorrow. So coming up next is The Hype with Wanjira L. Good evening.